Let's do this.
What is virtualization?
You're gonna learn today.
Innovate like a startup, deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's gonna be a great day.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Oh yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Aero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 148. My name is Pete Fletcher, and joining me once again is Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, buddy?
Feeling a little well-rested.
Oh, yeah?
Well, I mean, the vSphere 7 launch has happened. I can actually catch up on some sleep now. I got all my deliverables done. It's
VMware has, vSphere 7, VCF 4, Tanzu. There is so many things going on at VMware right now. There's we're going to be pretty busy for the next couple of weeks, man. I think we're going to have to just have maybe we'll just call it 7 month. I don't know. We got to come up with something
series seven,
fancy.
Man.
Series
the
7.
The 7 series.
Yeah. Yeah, we need to come up with something good. But man, I'll tell you, out the gate, we're going to start with a great one. We're going to talk about some Kubernetes, specifically vSphere with Kubernetes. And helping us in the conversation is one of our brothers in arms, Mr. Glenn Sizemore. Glenn, welcome back to the podcast.
How you doing, Pete? I'm currently surrounded by a fortress of toilet paper, standing in a tub of hand sanitizer. I'm ready to go. Let's do this.
I know where to go, at least. Yeah, if I leave my house, I'll just go straight to Glenn's. Awesome. Well, Glenn, I'm glad you're joining us. But the official guest of the podcast is, in my opinion, probably one of the folks at VMware that knows the most about this topic, Kubernetes and vSphere with Kubernetes. And that is Mr. Miles Gray. Miles, welcome to the podcast.
Glad to be back, Pete. You're awful way, way too kind, though. I don't know if I'm one of those guys.
I say that to all the guests. So Miles, you've been doing a lot of things. I know you've been speaking a lot about vSphere with Kubernetes. That's the new title. So that was formerly Pacific, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we announced it at VMworld US last year, I think it was. Maybe it was US or Europe. I think it was US. Project Pacific, which is the whole Kates control plane integrated into vSphere natively, native pods and all that kind of good stuff. So we talked about that for a while. It's been in development for a couple of years now, and it's finally manifested itself, or at least a part of it, in vSphere with Kubernetes, which we launched 2 days ago.
Yeah, for sure.
It's kind of crazy that thing is out there now. It's real and we can talk about it.
Yeah,
no, exactly. I was tweeting something today and I was like, oh man, I got to check myself. Can I actually say, I can say this, it's released.
Absolutely. So I know the three of us are going to have a lot of questions for you, but why don't you set the level? So, we've talked a little bit on this podcast before about what Pacific is, and I know things have slightly changed. And so maybe this is a good time to just give us the quick and dirty, give us a couple of minute explanation of sort of what vSphere for Kubernetes is and why we should care.
Sure. And I think it's important to note that it's more than just Kubernetes that's installed on top of vSphere. Anybody with half a brain and half an hour can go onto GitHub and use Cluster API and you spin up Kates on vSphere, right? So it's not a hard thing to do per se anymore, but there's a lot more to it than that. Whenever you bring it into an enterprise and you want to make it robust and ready for, actual production kind of workloads, there are some controls that need to be put into place. There are concerns around security, availability, cost, performance, all of these bits and pieces. And these bits and pieces usually come from the sysadmin up, right? So the sysadmin generally care about, is everything secure? Have I got enough storage? Is it going to not, cost me an arm and a leg to run this thing because the developer is going to go wild on it. So they care about all the governance end of things, and the developers, they don't want to talk to a sysadmin ever, right? So if you log a ticket, you're doing it wrong. They just want their CI pipeline. They want to deploy the latest thing that they read on Hacker News into production today, right? So how do you get those two worlds to kind of meet in the middle? And that's what we're trying to build, or not even trying to build, it's released now, so I can't keep saying that. That is what we have built with vSphere with Kubernetes, is sort of the best of both of those worlds. So we got some governance in there for the sysadmins, but we've got the self-service for the developers too.
And, I know that our audience is probably more of those infrastructure folks, so I just want to take a second and pull on that steering wheel and swerve this conversation just for a moment. Before anyone gets up on their high horse and starts, preaching about, needs to control and whatnot, I think if you walk 10 steps in the foot of the average enterprise developer, it is instantly very easy to understand how they live in that world. They are judged on their ability to create things that do not exist from thin air. How they do that does not enter the equation at all, right? So anytime that you just introduce another step in their lives, all you're doing is making it harder for them to actually complete what they're there to do. So by providing an infrastructure that almost codifies this concept of DevOps into a platform, it just makes it so much easier for these two groups to coexist and support one another, not through PowerPoint and organizational structure, but literally in the infrastructure that they're using to support the application stack.
And, you know, Glenn and I have been back and forward some ideas for VMworld sessions on similar topics like this, and maybe it makes sense to bring in some of that here, but we've always had APIs in vSphere, right? That's not new. You know, there's always been PowerShell, there's always been APIs, there's been Python SDKs and Go SDKs, and all of these bits and pieces out there that are quote unquote developer friendly or, you know, developer facing.
Yeah.
However, that's not really how they got consumed. So what we've built on vSphere with Kubernetes is not just an extension of that. It's not just, you know, the same old REST or SOAP-based API. It's a completely different consumption model. It's a desired state system. You tell the system what you would like to have. You know, I want a TKG cluster, and off it goes and creates a Kubernetes cluster for you, and you get a cluster back. Whereas before, the workflow was more, okay, what's the API to create a VM from an OVA? Okay, let's do that. And then we'll figure out how we're going to send keystrokes to the VM once it's booted. And then we're going to try and, you know, run an Ansible script against that, right? So you're going from this
super simple is what you're saying.
Right, yeah.
Well, it was stacking different layers of abstraction together in kind of a it was like a recipe, but it was very sometimes fluid of how much butter you used.
Right. So now it's a menu rather than a set of ingredients. You order off the menu, you don't go out and buy the ingredients and put them together yourself. So if you think about it from a developer perspective and what they're being asked to do by the business, what the business is asking developers to do is derive business value, right? Build features, build pieces of software that deliver value to the business in that line of business application. Almost none of the time is that business value realized by orchestrating infrastructure. So what we've done is we looked at that and said, okay, how do we just make the infrastructure consumption as simple as possible so that all that the developer has to do is, you know, do a few Kubernetes manifests or some such orchestration system, send these desired state model YAML files and manifests to it. It takes care of all the hard infrastructure stuff so that they can just get on with what they do, which is building applications that actually deliver business value, not something that they have learned is what delivers business value, which might in the past have been infrastructure management, but in our opinion, not anymore.
Yeah. And that's really like, I don't know, in my opinion, that is really the takeaway from this launch, guys, is like it's up leveling the infrastructure. You know, we were watching Tech Field Days earlier today, and there was a question at a certain point. They were like, you know, are you guys redefining SDDC? What's going on here? And really what I think is happening is we are attempting to pull the industry up stack and say, look, guys, stop obsessing over the minutiae that no one actually cares about outside of this vertical. It's all inside baseball, and it's not producing direct value for anyone. It's not why any of us are here. Right? Instead, let's move to these platform-based approaches and up-level our skill set a little bit. Move up the stack, get closer to the application, get closer to the development team, closer to the actual value chain, using automated systems and intelligent software to manage the vast majority of that minutia so that you have the time to get to all this next stuff, right? Because whether you like it or not, this is coming. You are not avoiding this. This is not going to be an open stack. This is not going to be a transitory thing. Containers and Kubernetes have successfully crossed the bridge from developer hit zone to a next generation deployment paradigm. There is already software that only supports Kubernetes. You cannot install it unless you can stand up a workload cluster. So like we have to get ready for this world. It's happening.
Well, and two things. One, I love that you said, you know, talked about the stuff that's only going to be on Kubernetes. We're already starting to see some traditional databases. I mean, Oracle and SQL, you know, you can just spin them up. But I also like that you mentioned the O word, because from my days of cursing at OpenStack, some of the challenges were, you know, kind of the ecosystem. And one thing I noticed, Miles, can you talk a little bit about this? There's a registry service. There's a bunch of services that are coming with this. This isn't just, you know, cluster API you're spinning up. You've got Kubernetes, you know, basic etcd and some things and some VMs. What all else is coming with this to help support this?
That's a great point. And I think that that stands to what Glenn was saying, is stop obsessing over the minutiae and just consume things. So if you look at what vSphere with Kubernetes actually manifests itself as, if, for example, you deploy a workload to vSphere with Kubernetes, it will ask for an IP address that is load balanced. It will get an IP address that is load balanced. You don't need to interact with NSXT. You don't need to do any setup. It just delivers you the service.
That's nice.
Likewise with storage. You ask for some storage. You know, I want a 50 gig file share. I want 100 gig block volume. Boom, you got it. I don't care what the back end is. The service delivers it to me.
Well, and this also talking about early, you know, Glenn mentioning the thing about having to wait on tickets and developers being slowed down. I think back to the networking team, which I generally affectionately referred to as those terrorists. And in a lot of orgs I worked in, they controlled the load balancers. And I mean, it sometimes would be days before anyone would listen to my ticket. And if you think about, you know, load balance, you got to get the storage team, which I was a storage admin. So obviously tickets were instantly fulfilled. But all it takes is one of these teams being slow at provisioning or being on vacation and not having enough redundancies or screwing up the provisioning because humans aren't as good versus these backend services that are just transparently taking care of it. That sounds like the developer is actually going to get work done.
Well, if you think about it from your perspective as a sysadmin, your perception of the network team was, oh, these guys are really slow. I don't want to have to log a ticket or deal with them. That is the dev's perception of us, right? They don't want to have to deal with us because they have to go through tickets and it's going to take days. So how do we fix that? And to us, this is how we fix it.
Well, this is also better than them grabbing a credit card and going devs gone wild on public cloud or devs creating their own infrastructure with no backups and no redundancy. So this sounds like a great middle ground to maintaining sovereignty and custody and compliance versus the alternatives that devs sometimes found before.
But like things, the fear is still there as the infrastructure manager that, hey, you know, I have certain X amount of resources. I don't want, you know, I'm afraid that, you know, I'm afraid that this could potentially, you know, you hear containers, you build many things. Who knows? This could end in, you know, like I could have all these orphaned objects that are like sprawling all over my environment and taking all my space.
Yeah. You know, so again, like back to that theme of trying to encourage everyone to pull up. Look, if you still want to build a bespoke environment, we'll just sell you vSphere, right? You want to go put together a cluster, we'll sell you the components and you can do that. But honestly, we've talked to our customers where we've gone out there and looked at the industry and we don't think that's where the value is, right? We think that the value has moved up chain. This starts with HCI, right? It starts with a hyper-converged platform where we're taking compute, storage, and networking, and we're managing them as a conglomerate resource. And we don't have to get into the minutiae of those three legs of just the infrastructure stool. But then as you move up that value chain, right, there's no downside to making this easier. To your point, Pete, right? Like, yeah. So people, if you fail to get the infrastructure to respond fast enough, then they just go somewhere that does. Well, the data actually backs that up. 2019 was the first time ever that we've seen line of business IT spend outstrip actual on-premises core IT spend. It was 51% versus 49%. So for the first time ever, we actually took more money and filtered it out through end of line of business units to go build apps and support business directly because they weren't able to get that done through the core IT services. So at the end of the day, you only have so many people. Those people can only get so much done. And every time you choose to hold on to one of those minutiae tasks, you're choosing to not have the bandwidth to get to the next thing, to not get to that growth project or that transformation project that you know is there, the wish list that you know you're trying to get to. You're justifying not being able to get to it because you have to do what you're doing right now. And it just becomes this self-defeating service. When in reality, if you embrace the simplicity, you get the ability to shift your people forward, You get the actual cycles to get the time to work on this stuff. And then more importantly, with what we're talking about with vSphere with Kubernetes, we've actually gone and peeked around the corner a little bit and taken what would have been a really big disruptive thing in this industry, a brand new application deployment management paradigm. And instead of forcing you to manage it like you had to do with public clouds when that first came up as this whole new thing using Gartner's modal transitioning management system, right? Instead, what we get to do is spin it up alongside your existing workload and infrastructure, leveraging the same exact staff, the same exact tools, get better integration between those teams. Like, why would you fight this? I don't even understand the beginning of the argument when somebody starts to sit there and be like, that's not for us.
I think it's an interesting point is that we're doing this stuff alongside the old, you know, quote unquote old way of doing things, but it's the way that everybody does things today. So how do we take that old model and maybe fit it into a new model that allows for this more service-based consumption where we're admitting that applications are going to be a mixture of VMs, like, you know, AD for your SSO or something like that. Maybe you have a SQL database or an Oracle database that, frankly, no one's going to move the data out of that into MongoDB anytime soon, right? So you still got a dependency on those things. But you also want to build your application on top of Cates to take advantage of all that paradigm promises.
Yeah.
So how do you take all of those different services and bits and pieces and stitch them together? And in vSphere with Kubernetes, the concept that we've introduced is this namespaces concept. So if you're at all familiar with Kubernetes, it has a namespaces concept as well. And admittedly, we took some inspiration there. And in Kubernetes, it basically means a bag of stuff that makes up an application. And in vSphere with Kubernetes, it also means a bag of stuff that makes up an application. So you've got your, you know, your AD in there, you've got your databases, you've got your Kubernetes clusters, you know, all the stuff that makes up your application is inside of this vSphere with Kubernetes namespace. So we're kind of looking at moving the unit of management from a per VM basis to this namespaces concept where everything that encompasses that application is held within a namespace.
And okay. You
apply things to the namespace via policy. So, you know, there's a storage policy, there's a compute policy, there's RBAC assigned to it, security policies, and, you know, in future, maybe other types of policies as well that would, you know, dictate other things that would have business impact. But at the start, you know, all of these things are just built into the namespace. So whenever a development team or a project manager comes along and says, I've got this new project, it's got to be, you know, HIPPA, HIPAA. It's got to be compliant with that. So, okay, we just encrypt everything inside that namespace by default. We don't go and make the developers understand, you know, you need to encrypt these things on disk or anything. We just take care of it. You know, the sysadmin knows, he just assigns a policy and away you go. You let them do your thing.
More importantly, the policies that are assigned to the namespace are whitelisted. So they're not given anything that can do damage. They're working within a safe space.
So I do really like this idea, though, of being able to manage quotas on this. This is just something where every single time I've seen any type of dev automation environment, including cough, our own internal, if you don't quota things, people will run out of space and crash it.
Well, if you look at it from this perspective, and maybe this is a question that some of you guys that are listening in have in your heads as well. It's like, well, if this is Kubernetes, can I not just do this myself? And yeah, sure, you can do it yourself, but you own the life cycle and all that kind of stuff. But there is more to it than that. There's the day two, there's the management, there's the operating of the platform, and quotas and RBAC and, you know, security, they're all part of that. They're intrinsic and they're requirements. They're not nice to haves.
Well, and yeah, I can make my own repository. Well, I'll just create an NFS share and then I'll do some scripts to copy things. And Yeah. Oh, wait, I got to scan that. So I'll download it to my desktop and I'll run an antivirus and then I'll copy it. And then you question why, you know, the devs were downloading highly questionable, you know, Docker images from public Docker repos. It's because it was faster than, you know, what you're trying to build. Like, there's,
I think that is a really, really good point, is that developers are engineers.
Yeah.
If there is a problem, they will solve the problem. You need to get the hell out of the way.
Yep.
And let them solve the problem. So you need to make it as easy as possible for them to solve the problem, because if you are not part of the solution, you can bet your ass that they're going to go, I need a backup of that. Do you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to tar the file system. That's a backup.
So, and I'm going to store it right next to the document. Like the backups they create will not only not be backups, that they won't even be snapshots that aren't backups, but they'll also blow up your storage at the same time. So,
but more importantly, right? Like now you've got a team member that's spending time waiting on something that and trying to solve a problem that another portion of the team is solving. Right? We're wasting resources. And that, to my mind, just gets back to what this is all about. Like, look, there is nothing inside vSphere with Kubernetes that is 100% unique. You have to buy this product. You cannot have it, right? Because that's the whole point of Kubernetes. The whole point of Kubernetes is to not enable that to be possible. But there is so much stuff that you have to do to get production ready, side by side, traditional enterprise applications, next generation cloud native microservices running in Kubernetes to coexist inside a modern IT infrastructure. And if you want to go out and build that yourself, knock yourself out. It's a big lift. There's a couple dozen companies that are being wildly successful with it right now, and a couple thousand that are floundering trying to figure it out. Okay. Or you could just swerve onto this highway we've built here and connect your developers directly to the platform and get on with it, because you don't have to worry about how you're going to handle registry services or how you're going to orchestrate storage services and how you're going to allocate those resources amongst your teams. We've built the platform that does that for you.
And I think this whole new world doesn't just apply to Kubernetes in and of itself. Like, you know, we talk a lot about CI/CD and, you know, developer practices and being agile and shipping multiple times a day. And, you know, how realistic that is depends on your organization. But yeah. CI/CD and things like that, they require robust automation systems to enable those workflows to happen, right? So say if your application is like most applications out there, not just built in isolation, but has dependencies on other things. If you want to have a CI/CD model around an application like that, then you need an automation framework, or, you know, well, this is what we built with vSphere with Kubernetes, is something that just allows you to automate that entire end-to-end stack really easily. So spinning up a cluster itself, like a Kubernetes cluster, if you need one of them from scratch, again, just to call in an API, you put it as part of your CI pipeline, boom, you've got a fresh cluster, away you go. So it's taking all of these bits and pieces, and yes, while they're exposed to the sysadmin, it's more of a... There are two views of the world here. You've got the sysadmin, and they define policies, but then you've got the developer, and they consume things, and they consume things in the way they want to consume things, not in a UI or, you know, via this portal or anything like that.
Yeah.
You want to run it in your CI system? No problem, dude. Knock yourself out.
And importantly, these two worlds are connected in ways that are that become incredibly important when you're trying to manage these systems in production, right? Little things like the fact that application tags that are propagated inside Kubernetes are then replicated up inside vSphere, so that when we're trying to find the right PV volume and troubleshoot what's going on in the back end, we can quickly share data between these teams and find what's actually going on. And it de-obfuscates what would otherwise be two islands of infrastructure that would require some third-party platform to unify them.
Yeah. I mean, we've been talking pretty high level so far, but I think like Glenn's point there is like a good segue into, you know, the bits and pieces that make it up and why it's a good platform.
Yeah.
Like, for example, the CNS thing that he was just referring to, but not by name. So cloud native storage is something that we introduced in 6.7U3, and it pulls all of the volume information from Kubernetes and puts it into vCenter. So the sysadmin has the same view over the storage as the Kubernetes admin. So if they're troubleshooting a problem together, they have the same language. They're talking about the same IDs. They've got the same labels and tags applied to things. You've got a consistent operating model. And this is something that I like to rant about from time to time, but DevOps as a term has been abused to, you know, it has no meaning anymore, right? But to me, what DevOps means is there's a shared responsibility between systems, so sysadmins, and the developers for the uptime of an application. So whatever you can do to make those teams work together more effectively is a better way of doing things. So by removing barriers like, oh, I'm a developer working in my Kubernetes, you know, system here, there's a problem with this persistent volume. Okay, that's, you know, SCSI ID, whatever. I'm going to tell my sysadmin, hey, there's a problem with, you know, this volume inside my Linux VM. oh, there's a whole lot of steps you got to go through to map that to the infrastructure, right? So by breaking down those walls and giving them a common language they can speak, it brings the two teams together and really sort of enables that DevOps, quote unquote, type culture.
And again, I'm just going to keep harping this home, especially if you do not have developers, particularly if you do zero in-house development, you uber duber want this product in those instances, because this is not avoidable. This is coming. Think of Kubernetes not as a development framework. Think of it as the world's most perfect and flawless software installer. It is the best MSI or apt-get you'll ever come across. And that is why it is unavoidable, right? It is just how software is going to be deployed in the future. So either get on board today and start ramping up, or lean into a platform that enables you to skip past that learning and just get straight to the step of leveraging and using the software.
So Miles, lots of new terms coming out with vSphere for Kubernetes, for me at least. I was hoping you could help me with some of these. Why don't we start with registry? What does that mean for vSphere Kubernetes?
Right, great question. So a registry is a repository of software. So you can think of it as like a catalog of stuff, or a place where software is stored. So whenever you do a Docker run Nginx, it's going to go out to a registry, say, I want Nginx, and it will pull down that image and run it on your system, right? So that's what a registry does. So what we built into vSphere with Kubernetes is a registry called Harbor, which was originally a VMware product. It is no longer a VMware product. It is actually an open source project that has been adopted by the CNCF as an official project. So that means it's got a critical mass. There are enough companies developing it independently that it can exist outside of a single company's financial backing, if you will. So it's now a community project. And we started this off maybe 4 or 5 years ago now. It came along with Vic at the same time was released. And they were kind of developed side by side. And Harbor is like the on-premises version of Docker Hub. So if you've ever used Docker to download and run something on your laptop, that's where it would pull from. So we built Harbor to do the same kind of thing on premises, but with a few little like value adds on top of that as well.
I got to say, the namings of these are really descriptive. Harbor, you know, like it's pulling it in. I do like some of the names that they use, but that makes sense.
Well, it's really cool. I've seen some of the capabilities. So one, being able to do security scanning and like building pipelines where you chain Harbor repos together. So the idea being that the developers can work, they can check their code in to a dev one, then that will push it into a testing one. The testing one will do some things like run security scans. So you've got things like Claire out there that can tap into that. And obviously intrinsic security is a big thing. We have our own capabilities we're looking to help with. So, okay, we've scanned the code, we know it's secure, but now we need to test the code if we're going to do CI/CD. And so go push that into a test environment, come back and say, oh, wow, it blows up, you know, shove it back at dev, or, oh, it cleared, it passed all the tests, move it on to the production repo, and then it copies the production repo. And then from there, you trigger your actions. And so the idea all the way from the dev checking code all the way through security checks, through tests, through the testing environments, all, you know, chaining these Harbor repos together can help build that pipeline. And yes, you know, it goes back to that earlier question. Can someone just install their own Kubernetes and do some things? These are all the things you're going to have to build. Otherwise, if you want to kind of go your own path, you have to pick a project and hope it has critical mass and try to build that. And then if there's issues with it, you're going to have to go find support for that separately. It's not just Kubernetes. It's an ecosystem.
And to your point, John, right? It's not just build. It's build and maintain. You are picking this up forever. Or you can choose to lean into one of these platforms that just removes it from your plate forever. We are at one of those forks in the road where you get to decide what IT for you is going to look like for the next probably 10 or 15 years.
Well, I mean, OpenStack had a great life cycle. Every deployment lasted just as long as its support cycle did. And then you ran and found a new job before you had to update it. So we've come a long way from there.
If you look at like the length of time that we support a release for, like what is our EOL delta from when we release a product to when we EOL it? It's a long time.
I think it's like 6 years.
Right. So could you imagine looking after the system that you built 6 years ago? I know I wouldn't. So
no.
I've never worked anywhere 6 years, Miles. So that's someone else's problem.
That's what I mean. But I think there's some neat integrations in the namespaces concept. Again, everything comes back to this namespaces concept, right? everything revolves around this as the unit of management. So whenever you create a namespace, it automatically creates a project and harbor for you to push your images in that are also RBAC linked to whoever you gave permissions to on that namespace has the same permissions for that registry repo on Harbor. So all of it's just linked together. If you assign RBAC in one place, it's just done the whole way through the solution suite. So it's not like you need to go into all these little systems and say, oh, I need to give, you know, team A permissions to this on Harbor and on the namespace and everything, right? You do it in one place and it's done everywhere.
Which, if you think about this from a day two operations perspective, right, that's the kind of stuff that really starts to pay itself back, just the same way that policy-based management pays itself back by building those policies up front and sorting our workloads, having everything deployed with this intermediary step. Then when we want to make a change come day two or day 642, it's easy because we've got this simple platform that acts as an intermediary. We're working with declarative end states. We simply change the end state and we let the platform carry it away. Want to change your deployment, add a new resource, remove a resource, you modify the namespace. It propagates throughout the stack. It takes it away. You're not dealing with a bunch of imperative code. Like, again, there's more important stuff for you to do. The world is literally on fire. We have actual problems to solve. We don't have time to waste resolving and reinventing fire over and over and over again. We need to get to the actual problems.
Or writing internal wiki pages, which are like, if you change a permission here, don't forget to go and do it there as well. Otherwise, it's all gone.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So, if your documentation involves, go to this Slack channel and read this message.
So speaking of the world being on fire, what about like disaster recovery or even data protection for that matter? I mean, you know, these are considerations for infrastructure managers, obviously, but, you know, I'm curious, you know, how does that apply to vSphere for Kubernetes?
Kind of a religious war here. And I think it depends what your background is, right? If your background is enterprise, DRDP, they're king. If your background is I build SaaS apps, why the hell would I need DRDP? I built it into the app. You know, so I think there are two different camps here, you know, and it depends which one we're talking about.
Yeah, I don't think that, and to Miles's point, I don't think there's a right answer because it very much depends on where you are in that transition. Because again, we're in the transition. There are air quote container applications today that are essentially just monoliths that have been repackaged into a container format, but nothing else has been modified.
That is not CNA, by the way, everyone that's listening.
Yeah, no, exactly. That is not what we built. We built a true microservice all the way from the top to the bottom. But look, a lot of the traditional three-tier persistence databases, that's what those are. They just picked them up and they lifted them into a container and that's where it is. That's why if you go talk to them, they'll say, no, leave it where it is in a VM or on bare metal or inside this SaaS platform, because moving it into a container does absolutely nothing. It changes nothing from the actual data persistence and day-to-day management perspective. You still have to manage it the same exact way. But if you're building a new application, the odds are you're not going to lean into those traditional persistence data stores. You're going to use some more 12-factor methodologies, have a more global presence, and think about data persistence in a slightly different manner. You'll manage your criticality paths differently. And those systems just end up having less fault overall and a much more narrow exposure from a data protection point of view, to Miles's point. They just don't rely on infrastructure level solutions. However, if you want one, we have it. It's called Valero. Works out of the box. We can back up anything and we can enable you to have those traditional data protection, disaster recovery, failover type workflows if you want them. It's not something we see a lot of though.
Yeah, I think if what your organization or what your enterprise does is lifts traditional apps and puts them into a container and says, there's my containerized application, sure, we have an answer for you. So we've got Valero, it can do backup and restore, and there's a plugin that's being released with 7.0 as well that'll do VADP snapshots and ship them into S3 if you want to do that, or Dell PowerProtect as well. So there are options if you want to run, you know, those kinds of workloads in Kubernetes. If you're running a true quote-unquote CNA-based workload, you sort of solve that, or you have to solve that at a higher level. You need to solve that at the application level, because actually quiescing and providing you know, reliable backups and snaps for a highly distributed application is really complex if you try and do it from an infra up layer. But if you look from the app down, it becomes a lot, not trivial, but you have a lot more visibility into how things are done.
Yeah, I had I have this conversation often over in VMware Cloud and AWS land, and I'm actually working on a blog post series right now to kind of help illustrate this a little bit better. But the way that I typically summarize it for customers is when we're deployed inside a single data center, right? The failure domain or the amount of time you can anticipate elapsing before we can begin to recover from an unexpected fault, typically we're looking at like 45 minutes to an hour, right? When you're just inside a single data center, something goes wrong, takes about an hour to figure out what happened, get it back, whatever it may be. We can mitigate some of that with multi-site technology, something like a stretch cluster or a metro storage cluster, right? Those systems tend to have the recovery times down in 10 to 15 minutes, right? Because with a whole nother hot standby site, we can declare death much, much faster. And by having a standover site, we can get those workloads back up and running much, much faster. But if you want failover in seconds, there is only one way to do it. And it's in the application itself. Your application has to be written in such a manner that it is constantly analyzing state and is simultaneously failing over if it detects a fault. There is nothing we can do in the application, in the infrastructure layer, that is going to be able to do seamless failover in mere seconds.
But what about SMP FT?
I mean, you want to put 100, look, honestly.
There's like a max of 4 VMs per host. No, you have to throw tons of network throughput.
Yeah, you better have 100 gig bandwidth between those sites if you want to have like 4 of those things firing at once. Like,
oh yeah, you can't. Actually, that's not supported. That's not supported between data centers. There is no FT support between.
But whenever we're talking about cloud native apps, true cloud native apps, it's not about data protection or... Sorry, there is a data protection element to it, but there is not a data a disaster recovery element to it. It is disaster avoidance. Yeah. You deploy your app in such a way that disasters cannot take it down. You still need data protection. You know, you need to checkpoint things in case someone corrupts something or puts, you know, something happens to your data processing. Obviously, you need to be able to backup and restore, but you don't have DR in the traditional sense. You do disaster avoidance rather than DR itself.
And typically, your recovery flows, if something bad were to happen, don't involve restoring. It's deploying new and standing up. You just you rebuild from your repositories and attach back to the existing data set.
All right, well, Miles, I want to give you the last word. I know we've barely scratched the surface when it comes to talking about vSphere for Kubernetes, but what would you leave us with in terms of where to go to look for things or things to consider when trying to maybe bone up on our knowledge with vSphere for Kubernetes?
So I guess first off, I'll talk about like super high level takeaway. If you're a sysadmin, we've got the governance that you care about. You can do quotas, you can do policies, you can do RBAC, security, all that stuff. If you're a developer, we've got the self-service that you want. So we're not locked down. You don't have to log things in a ticketing system. It's all defined up front by your sysadmin. You just say, you know, how much storage, compute, networking, all that stuff that you need up front, and then your self-service from then on. So both sides of the house, we're catering to you. And that's really the drive behind vSphere with Kubernetes. And just remember, like, this is the initial release. So it looks like we have a lot of stuff here. And we do have a lot of stuff here, but this is only going to increase over time as well. You know, that we've got other things that we didn't even talk about, like the pod service and how we can build internal things on top of that that might enable other services in future. You know, there's a whole landscape of stuff that this is going to evolve into. So we're really only at the precipice here. As far as resources and where to go to learn more, the documentation is actually really excellent. I don't know why I sound surprised by that for vSphere with Kubernetes. So if you want to like look at some screenshots and see how it works, you can go read the documentation. I believe there's a HOL coming out. If not, it's already out, but it'll be out very, very soon, where you can actually take it out for test drive, kick the tires, see how you create namespaces, how do they get consumed by the dev side of the house. So for me, the best way to learn things is getting hands-on. So I would absolutely encourage everyone to go and check out the HOL.
Very nice. John, Glenn, anything else before we take off?
Yeah, man. You know, we deep dived on the Kubernetes piece today, but you know, something else that was a big part of this launch that went out this week is the bigger VMware Cloud initiative, which is obviously what touches my heart pretty closely. And it is the infrastructure side of what we're talking about today, right? It is, even if all my hard sells and trying to convince you that you really cannot avoid this, because that really is what I believe. If you don't agree with me and you think I'm full of crap, you still really want to take a close look at this latest release and what we've done here, particularly around VMware Cloud and the VMware Cloud Foundation, that level setting capability, because I really do mean it. Like, what we are being asked to do as an industry They are pouring gasoline on the fire that is already burning in our data center and handing us a little spoonful of water and saying, what's your problem? Move faster. Like, if you don't start leaning into these systems and get ahead of this, you are going to drown. There's no way to avoid it. And I think what we've done with VMware Cloud, shipping a common ubiquitous layer that we run in the AWS cloud, we run inside the Azure cloud, we run inside the Google cloud, and now we also give you a private instance through Cloud Foundation that you can run in your own private data center. Again, it provides this leveling function for the industry, and I think it's coming at a time when we desperately need it. Because again, we've got real problems we've got to solve. As a species, we've got shit to do.
Right, and as much as it's nice to talk about individual products and individual features, what we've delivered with vSphere with Kubernetes is the VMware platform. It doesn't matter that it's vSphere with Kubernetes or that it uses NSX for networking or vSAN to the backend storage. It runs on VMware, right? That is kind of the takeaway here, that it is the platform for whatever app you want to deploy, whether it's VMs or containers or Kubernetes. We've got it.
Oh yeah. Hey, like Pat said, right? Any application on any device on any cloud. This is good. All right, man. John, what a great way to start this 7 series talking about vSphere for Kubernetes. Glenn, thank you for aiding in the conversation. Miles, thanks for giving us this base level understanding of how things are changing and how vSphere for Kubernetes is a big part of this new release. I'm sure we're going to have you on many more times as this gets bigger and maybe we can dive a little deeper in certain aspects of this. But really, thank you so much for setting the foundation for us today.
Pleasure as always. You know where I am.
All right. Well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. You can subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. A big thanks to Glenn and Miles for talking vSphere for Kubernetes. We're back next week, but until then, bye for now.
Enough of this jibber jabber.